Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of food, health, and the environment, and on the show we cover policy, science, popular attitudes, the media, cultural beliefs and assumptions, and everything that concerns our well-being, both as individuals, as community members, as a society, as well as part of the ecological web of all living beings on planet Earth. So each week on the show, we talk with different advocates, thought leaders, experts, scientists, authors, filmmakers, and more to explore the many different facets of our interconnected world that affect the health of us as individuals and all of us collectively. On today's show, I'm really excited to have a guest on a topic that I've been covering for a while. Recently, in fact, we covered it in an earlier program, an interview with Kristen Lawless, the journalist who wrote a book called Formerly Known as Food. I also did an article on Truthout, and we're talking about the present administration's aggressive attack on the longstanding scientific understanding and public health policy, both in this country and globally, that shows that the healthiest nutrition for newborn infants anywhere in the world is, in fact, their own mother's milk. And we'll be discussing more why that is, what the administration has done, and what we can all do about it. My guest today is Lucy Sullivan. She's the founding executive director of an organization called 1,000 Days. The reason the organization is called 1,000 Days is that this wonderful organization, which is active globally, focuses on infant nutrition for the first 1,000 days of life, which is a critical window for laying down a lifelong template of baseline good health. So 1,000 days has been active in this recent semi-crisis instigated by the administration's actions. You'll be learning more about that. And I'm delighted to welcome to Connect the Dots Lucy Sullivan.
Sure. Yeah, happy to provide a quick recap. So in May, every year in May, there's a meeting called the World Health Assembly. It takes place in Geneva at the World Health Organization headquarters, and every country in the world attends. And it's really where global health policy setting happens. And this year, there was a resolution that was introduced by the country of Ecuador to basically reaffirm the importance of breastfeeding and say breastfeeding is really important for the health of mothers, the health of babies. And the purpose of the resolution was really to provide all the countries around the world an update on some guidance that the World Health Organization had put together on things like infant feeding in humanitarian emergencies and in natural disasters, breastfeeding and HIV/AIDS. And so it was very much a run-of-the-mill policy resolution on breastfeeding. We did not expect that there would be any pushback, any real criticisms, because there was nothing that we had seen in the resolution that was particularly controversial. So we were quite surprised when we started hearing reports of the U.S. government, the Trump administration, looking to kill the resolution. They didn't want this resolution to see the light of day. And the reports were that the Trump administration was actually threatening Ecuador, which was the country that was introducing this resolution, threatening them with trade sanctions and threatening military aid, pulling their military aid, et cetera, because they were introducing this resolution. So Ecuador dropped it. And that, I think those the reports of those threats certainly sent a chilling effect through the World Health Assembly, and no country really wanted to step up and introduce this resolution. It had somehow become toxic until Russia decided that it would step forward and introduce the resolution, which was, in our view, quite an interesting geopolitical turn, given the interesting relationship between the U.S. and Russia these days. And as soon as Russia introduced the resolution, all the other countries sort of fell behind it and threw their support behind it. So it was quite interesting. And then from there, the U.S. government, through various negotiations, the Trump administration tried to weaken in the resolution introducing problematic language. But all in all, the resolution passed without too much watering down. But it absolutely took advocates, you know, that like us, that track these things and have been very involved in these things. It took us by surprise. We did not expect the vehemence and the intensity that this negotiation provoked in the Trump administration.
The argument that they made for doing this was apparently in contradiction to the actions and the fear that was the actions they did and the fear that that invoked in the other countries. I mean, they said they were just merely trying to give people a choice as to whether mothers might choose to nurse or might choose to use infant formula. And, I mean, if their real purpose was to give a choice, merely a choice, why the spread? You know, I mean, it seems a bit
different. Yes, that's exactly right. And I think the administration was probably surprised by the backlash once the reports started coming out in the media. There was a lot of public outcry against the administration and the reports of these actions in terms of using the bullying tactics that they used sort of the stance that they took, you know, opposing a resolution on breastfeeding, which has been shown to, you know, save the lives of over 820,000 young children every year.
Wow.
You know, that could be those lives could be saved with more, you know, with more and better breastfeeding practices. And so that's really important. And that's why, you know, these kinds of resolutions matter to send that signal to, you know, to countries around the world. Hey, you need to do more to support mothers to breastfeed, because this is really a life and death matter for a lot of children and even women. The benefits of breastfeeding are certainly just as important for women in terms of how it protects against breast cancer, ovarian cancer, heart disease. So really critical. And so when you have the Trump administration taking a stand against something like breastfeeding, you know, it sort of begs the question, you know, whose interests are they looking to serve? So I think the Trump administration quickly pivoted to that language around, hey, this isn't about, we're not about blocking breastfeeding. We just want to give mothers, you know, the choice and the information. But this, you know, they did try to reframe the issue as one that's, you know, about choice, you know, formula, you know, it's important that mothers have access to formula. But in reality, access to formula is not the issue, not at all. The issue really at hand is the choice between public health and private profit. And that's the game that the Trump administration was in many respects playing in protecting sort of the infant formula industry's interests in, you know, in seeing this any resolution and any measure that calls on countries to protect breastfeeding, they hate, because that means restricting their marketing. And, you know, in some sense, the Trump administration is, you know, playing by the playbook that the Reagan administration used back in 1981. So in 1981, there was this measure called the International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes, or the code. And what the code is, it outlines a set of rules for companies to follow when it comes to the way that they should be marketing their products. And it calls on countries to implement laws and regulations restricting the marketing of formula, because the marketing of formula was shown to be having extremely detrimental effects on not only breastfeeding rates, but on child survival rates. So children were literally dying as a result of the aggressive push by formula companies in the 70s and 80s, particularly in places like sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia and Latin America. And so the WHO adopted this code. And that code has been sort of a bone of contention for over 40 years. The U.S. government, under the Reagan administration, was the only country to have voted against the code, citing that it runs counter to our constitutional guarantees of free speech and freedom of information. So that freedom of information piece is definitely a page that was taken out of that playbook by the Trump administration, and claiming that this was an issue of consumers or mothers having information and access to formula.
you know, to the average person, you know, that might be listening to the program who's not acquainted with these issues, it might seem like, you know, why would this or the Reagan administration or any administration be so concerned about, you know, a few small companies that produce infant formula, and, you know, why would they be espousing them, and, you know, and how much of a dent could these companies be potentially making in the earliest nutrition and then the future health and lives of children? You know, it may be hard to imagine the actual scope of, you know, and also who these companies are and what the scope of their activities is. I think that, you know, many people may not be aware of that if you think of that a little bit for us.
Absolutely. Well, you said, you know, there's a few small companies. The reality is they're not small. They're giant multinational behemoths that are involved in the marketing and manufacturing of infant formula. The infant formula industry globally is about a $70 to $80 billion a year industry, and that has grown substantially. Only about, I would say, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, you know, the number was closer to $40 billion. And the growth, the massive growth that has come, you know, over the last several years for the infant formula business has come from developing markets, has come from places like Indonesia and China and Thailand and Vietnam and South Africa and places that are sort of the markets of the future for these companies, places where you know, birth rates are growing. More women are entering the workforce, and therefore have, you know, aren't, you know, staying home to breastfeed. And these are big markets where they're spending billions of dollars every year marketing and pushing their products on people that, you know, quite frankly don't need them or even can't afford them, because still many people in a lot of these lower and middle income countries can't afford infant formula. And so you have situations where families are spending an exorbitant amount of their household budget on just feeding their babies. And, you know, it's once you stop breastfeeding as a woman, it's very hard to try to start back up again. So once the companies get, you know, parents hooked on formula, you know, they have to keep going. So these markets they're big markets, and, you know, the way that they grow, you know, in addition to all the demographic factors I talked about, is the marketing. And so the way that these products are marketed in places like Asia, for example, is appealing to parents' desires for their kids to be the smartest and for the kids to do best in school and grow up to be, you know, sort of a wealthy corporate titan, and so the products that are marketed under the name of like HiQ, which, you know, sort of indicates or connotes that the formula is going to give your kid higher IQ. You know, in sub-Saharan Africa, you look at the marketing of these products, and you know, they talk about sort of, you know, the healthy, strong children, and they show, you know, sort of the children playing soccer or football, as it's called in other parts of the world. You know, so appealing to parents' desires and wishes. And, you know, when you have that and you're confronted with that, you know, sexy, glamorous, aspirational marketing, and, you know, you're a poor woman, you know, who is, you know, wondering whether she's making enough milk, wondering if her breast milk is adequate enough, you know, you're seduced into buying these products. And so it's that kind of unethical marketing that many of us that work in public health and in the global nutrition space really really want to see counteracted. And so the way to do that is really through legislation, through restricting the marketing of these products, and also calling on companies. Go ahead, please.
Let me just ask, is there any science that supports the aspirational claim that this improves IQ or, you know, athleticism? I mean, is that actually, you know, is there any evidence of that or not?
It's quite the opposite. So breastfeeding, there is actually science that shows the that children that are breastfed longer do better on tests of IQ. In fact, the correlation is, breastfeeding is correlated with a 3-point increase in IQ. So we know this because there are things in breast milk. There are special proteins and fatty acids that are really important for a baby's brain development, but also the act of breastfeeding, which is, it requires a lot of skin-to-skin contact and usually a lot of eye contact, and that sort of nurturing care between mom and baby actually does also fuel a baby's brain development. It's very different than putting some processed food, which is what formula is, in a bottle and giving the bottle to the kid, and the baby, and in some cases, unfortunately, propping that bottle up with a pillow and leaving the baby, while you go do something else. It's a very different dynamic and experience. So in fact, it's quite the opposite. In terms of the physical health, we know that breastfeeding protects against so many diseases that are, unfortunately common, and unfortunately in many parts of the world children die from. So diarrhea, pneumonia, these are diseases that are killers of young children in many parts of the world, and breastfeeding protects against those diseases. But even here in the United States, breastfeeding protects against SIDS, the sudden infant death syndrome, which is a leading cause of infant mortality in the United States. And so this notion that that formula is going to make your kid healthier or smarter is completely misleading. And it's, again, that type of misleading marketing that these companies are very good at and that we're fighting tooth and nail against.
It's really interesting because the role of marketing, for industry agendas of various kinds is just becoming a more and more visible problem on so many different fronts. And I've been in media for pretty much my entire professional life, so I'm kind of very often in position on this program and in my article reporting and everything of reporting on different facets of this. And it's kind of like, people are, the whole thing about marketing is that it makes whatever it is seem very appealing, seductive, speaking to your wishes and needs. And it's really hard to pull back from, because the whole definition of it is that, of course, it's designed to feel good. It's designed to speak to what you wish. And I would say that it's hard for everybody who's subject to marketing from any particular direction, even people who are, more sophisticated about the media, very well educated, to kind of pull back and look at that with a critical eye. But imagine the problem for people who don't have the benefit of a lot of education, who
That's
are
right.
struggling. They're even more vulnerable. And that is what is, so terribly unfair about this. So it's really, it's really terrific and very important that your organization is doing this work, and also the consciousness is raised, because the whole area of public health is so underrepresented as a value.
That's right.
And it really begins right where you're beginning.
Yeah, it really does begin in sort of the first 1,000 days. We have to get it right in that critical early few years of a child's life. You mentioned something, sort of the vulnerability, and it is vulnerability in terms of sort of the lack of resources or the lack of education, or but it's also vulnerability when a woman gives birth. She has to learn how to become a mother, and there's a lot of self-doubt. There's a lot of insecurity that even the best of us sort of endure. Mm-hmm. It was interesting to read something that Serena Williams, who had just given birth a few months ago to her baby, posted about her own insecurities about being a mother. And I think that the infant formula companies prey on that insecurity, on that uncertainty that a lot of new parents, regardless of whether you're a wealthy parent or a parent living in a poor community, that insecurity that a lot of parents face is, my baby getting enough milk? Is my baby healthy? Is my baby so fussy? Is my baby going to be, sort of able to cope in the world? And am I doing the right thing for my child? And so I think that's a big part of it as well. which is why we think, you know, this marketing is sometimes quite insidious, and there's so much that we try to do in sort of the context of public health to support women to breastfeed, and that is also, that involves things like, you know, making sure that her doctors and her healthcare providers understand breastfeeding and can help her when she encounters problems, that she has the support of family, that she has the support of her employers. That's why paid parental leave is such a critical component for breastfeeding success. I mean, we live in a country that is the only country in the world pretty much that has no paid, guaranteed paid maternity leave. And that is, you know, that is a recipe for, I think, for failure for a lot of families who are trying to give their baby the best start, and for mothers who are trying to breastfeed.
And the country we're talking about is the U.S. It's this country.
Exactly.
That, you know, that exceptionally does not even provide that baseline support where so many other countries, even ones that are not as developed, make that a social priority. Why don't we do that?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I think it goes back to Trump's tweet about this issue. He said, you know, the United States government strongly supports breastfeeding. And many of the responses I saw from people that I know to that tweet was, you know, if you supported breastfeeding, then you'd support paid parental leave. And I think there's growing sort of consensus in the United States that this is important. This is a family-friendly policy, making sure that parents have time to spend with their child on the birth of a child, et cetera. Because the reality is, in the United States, 1 in 4 women go back to work within 2 weeks of giving birth, and that's extraordinary. And it's not good for mom, and it's not good for baby, and it's not good for families. It's not good for anyone. So I think we're starting to see more sort of consensus out there in terms of that. I think the tricky bit is how you pay for it. And so, does government pay for it? Do companies pay for it, or do individuals pay for it? And there's a lot of different proposals out there. There's a Republican proposal. There's a proposal that's been introduced by two Democrats, and it all has to do with the amount of time that's guaranteed and who pays for it. And I think as a country, we haven't solved that yet. But my hope is that, you know, with these midterms coming up, that there will be more voices that are willing to, you know, to fight the fight on getting a good comprehensive paid leave program in the United States passed for the sake of families, for the sake of our future.
I think it's very important. You know, interestingly, when I was write on different topics in the areas of health, food, and environment. And when this surfaced, I was, you know, and I also have a background in early childhood development, and I was like, this is just a direct, you know, assault on the baseline health of, newborn children all around the world. And it's just, it's wrong, it can't be, and I began researching it further and pitching it, you know, to do an article for various of the outlets that I write for. And, you know, and it did find a home at Truthout, I'm happy to say, and, you know, listeners can go read that article on Truthout by, you know, Googling my name, Allison Rose Levy, and Truthout, you'll find the article. But I did also notice that the very kinds of delightful, bright women who would be editors or in areas of editorial responsibility and hold down those kinds of jobs, you know, were also people who took maternity leave and, you know, wanting to keep their job or needing to support their family are exactly, you know, the kind of, and they're not, you know, poor women necessarily at all, you know, but they would be a group of women who would transition their children rather young to infant formula. And then inquiring the article, I found there was actually, you know, kind of guilt, you know, like saying things like, well, we don't want to make mothers feel guilty. And, you know, from that, I kind of deduced, well, this might be making you feel guilty because of the economic circumstances of how, you know, the options that you have for your family, and you may feel badly about it, and it becomes a painful topic. And I have a lot of empathy for that, but I thought it was also kind of interesting because there were places that were like, well, we have to do this as a balance piece and show how formula is good too. And, you know, it's like, well, no, we don't because there's no evidence of that. So I thought that was, you know, rather interesting that surfaced. And, you know, it's an example of how a shift in values, a shift in social priorities also encounters both the marketing that, you know, we all at every level of society have received, as well as the experiences that have, you know, shaped us, that, you know, when, you know, we may be in a position to act as a gatekeeper, and, you know, so it's harder to get, you know, that information out there when many people, you know, kind of forced into the circumstance of having to leave their children so young. Anyway, this is my comment on the topic.
No,
but
that's exactly right. I think, you know, this notion that formula is a, you know, or how you feed your infant is a choice. Well, many women don't have a choice. They, you know, they have no choice but to use formula. And formula is, you know, a perfectly fine option. I have absolutely no problem with the product. It's the marketing of it that I have a problem with. There are babies who need to use formula. There are families who choose to use formula. And we need to make sure that it's nutritionally adequate, that it's safe, and that it's there. And we need to remove all the barriers that stand in the way of women reaching their own breastfeeding goals. If a mother decides she wants to breastfeed her baby for 3 months, fantastic. We should try to do everything that we can to support that. If she says she wants to breastfeed her baby for a year, same. And, you know, I think what we fall into the trap of, you know, kind of highlighting the individual cases a lot, right? So every family's circumstances are different, and every woman needs to make the choice that's sort of best for them and for their family, assuming that they have a choice, that they're not sort of, you know, sort of left with only sort of formula feeding because they have to go back to work because you know, they didn't get the support that they needed in the hospital to get breastfeeding off to the right start. You know, so it's really important that we think about these things also at a population health level, right? So, you know, what does it mean for, you know, 80% of babies in the United States to be formula fed? That's a big sort of population level shift in the way that babies were fed, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And, you know, there is data, strong data to support you know, the notion that breastfeeding actually reduces obesity, that is, it has a protective effect against obesity in children. So when, you know, the majority of the world's children are formula fed or are not, you know, being fed in accordance with the global guidelines, you have to ask yourself, what kind of effect is that having at a population level? And what kinds of, you know, problems are we going to see down the road, you know, in different societies, you know, health problems and just, you know, and sort of the healthcare costs and other costs that come, you know, with a, you know, with a less than healthy population.
Exactly right. I've reported a lot on the obesity epidemic, and we have a childhood obesity epidemic in this country. And it is, you know, the prime contributor, scientific research has shown, to the decreased longevity of the next generation.
Yes.
I mean, in other words, we were getting, you know, living longer and a little bit longer year by year, and now that trend is going in the other direction, a little bit shorter, a little bit less long in life, et cetera. And the prime cause is childhood obesity, and the health template for one's nutrition, you know, biological functioning and all of that is laid down in these, you know, in these 1,000 days that you speak of. And that's also prenatal, postnatal, and, you know, and up until the baby is 2 years old. So then at the other end of the spectrum, we're blaming people and saying, oh, you know, take care of yourself and make better choices, and we don't want to pay for your health care. I mean, the society is saying that. You're not saying that, and I'm not saying that. But the society is saying that. And, you know, as if each individual has brought down this problem upon themselves through their bad choices. But you know, economics and then this kind of marketing is actually creating a system that's forcing bad choices in many cases upon people and creating these long-term health effects and economic effects. And we can't just look at each individual and say it's up to you when we allow these systems to bear down on people in this manner.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, what's interesting watching kind of this all unfold in terms of the, you know, the opposition to the World Health Assembly resolution on breastfeeding in May was that one of the reasons why there was such strong opposition was because the resolution pointed to something called, you know, ending the inappropriate, the guidance on ending inappropriate marketing of foods for young children. And what that was, that guidance by the WHO was an attempt to do was say, you know, there's a lot of unhealthy products out in the market for young children, including these things called toddler formulas. So these things called toddler formulas have become very popular. These the infant formula companies have invented a fake feeding period and have started producing these products that are meant for children, you know, from the age 1 to age 3. And they are basically sugar-sweetened beverages for little kids. They are laden with sugar.
Terrible.
They are laden with sodium. They are they have things like corn syrup solids, and it's just junk food for little kids. It's marketed as, hey, it's really nutrition because it has these nutrients in it, and we've added DHA, you know, this ingredient that is linked to, you know, to brain development.
Brain health.
Yeah, and so they're putting, you know, so much money into marketing these products. They've become really popular in Asia, when in reality, after a kid turns 1 year old, they can just drink regular milk and eat a well-balanced diet, and they're fine. But the companies, again, are preying on parental insecurities. Oh, is your baby growing enough? Oh, he's a picky eater. You should give him this toddler formula. Oh, this has a special ingredient for brain development. It's going to help your kid be ready for school. But in reality, it's, you know, it's a problem because these products are super unhealthy in many respects, and it will, you know, if we're not going to do something about these products, at least, you know, in the United States, but also in other markets, they are going to continue to contribute to the problem of early childhood obesity, and that's a problem that we're seeing, of course, in the United States, but in many other parts throughout the world now as well.
Oh, that's just terrible. And, of course, the problem with the children becoming obese so young is that the other sequelae of obesity, whether it's diabetes, whether it's cardiac disease, you know, it doesn't just begin and end with obesity. It actually produces almost all of these inflammatory chronic conditions that now we have music in the background that undermine, you know, health lifelong, and that's why we have decreased longevity, because of these this particular, you know, setting it up in this way. I didn't realize that the toddler drinks actually had high fructose corn syrup. I mean, it's a cheap product, and it really dysregulates the entire sugar system. So of course it will be leading both to obesity and to diabetes. And, you know, before the current generation, we've never seen type 2 diabetes, you know, in so many young children, teenagers. It's kind of unheard of, except now, you know, it's happening because of, you know, these kind of reckless decisions. Really terrible.
Absolutely.
What can you do? I mean, what is your organization trying to do about, you know, about all of this to kind of curb some of this and get a handle? Like, what are your best leverage points?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's two fronts. Number one, companies. We have to call on companies to market their products in a responsible manner. And this day and age where, you know, sort of you can call out companies on social media in a very, you know, effective way, I think, you know, I think the time has come for there to be much more of a public questioning, a public outcry against some of these marketing tactics that companies are using to undermine breastfeeding, and quite frankly, the amount of lobbying that these companies engage in. And so, you know, no company should stand in the way of a mother breastfeeding, and no no company should be trying to influence policy that is about supporting mothers breastfeeding. And so I think that, that sort of the consumer outcry, the public outcry, can, you know, can hopefully encourage and push these companies to start cleaning up their act, start doing the right thing. There's, you know, as I said, the code is out there. They have to, no company follows the code. They're not playing by the rules. So these companies have to start playing by the rules. So I think that's sort of the first, you know, the first angle. And the second angle is, of course, governments. So governments are in a position to implement laws and regulations that restrict the kind of unethical and misleading marketing that I was talking about earlier, and whether those governments are in other countries or even our own government. You know, I don't think we will see a time where the U.S. government will restrict the marketing of infant formula in this country, but certainly they can. The U.S. government can take a strong stance in supporting other countries to take a look at this and to protect breastfeeding, and, you know, not do what we saw back in May in the World Health Assembly. I think, you know, the other thing is domestically in our own backyard, are we supporting women to breastfeed for as long as they want to and as long as it's recommended to? And, of course, the answer is no. You know, we talked about paid leave. We are advocating. We are pushing. We are in Congress, you know, meeting with members of Congress to talk about sort of the paid leave proposals and working with other groups and trying to lift up stories of families, of women in particular, that have suffered as a result of not having paid leave. I mean, there's heartbreaking stories of mothers who have to leave their child in the NICU. Their child was born prematurely. The baby's in the NICU because she has to go back to work. And she doesn't have her employer doesn't provide any kind of paid leave. And so, you know, these are the kinds of stories that we try to show policymakers, and we have to start moving the conversation from one of if we should have paid leave to, okay, we need paid leave and we need to get working on this and how are we going to do it? And then how we support women in this country. I mean, it was just, I think, a couple weeks ago that finally all 50 states in the United States you know, sort of allow breastfeeding in public. For, I think, a while, there were two states that, you know, had laws that prohibited breastfeeding in public. So we have to change the culture and social norms around breastfeeding and what's normal in terms of feeding. And that goes a long way in helping women feel supported to breastfeed. And then in hospitals, I mean, that's where breastfeeding in this country, at least most women learn how to breastfeed in a hospital and get their start in breastfeeding in a hospital. But the sad reality is that, you know, in a lot of hospitals, there's not, you know, the medical professionals there and the nurses aren't always trained in how to help a mom breastfeed. And so we need to make sure that that's happening and that mothers get the support that they need when they encounter problems breastfeeding and when the baby won't latch, when the baby's losing weight, what happens, and that she has the medical attention that she needs, you know, to make it a success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because when I was doing the research for this article on this subject, I talked with Professor Bruce Sturman, who's been a leading researcher into the unique properties, health-giving properties of breast milk, right? And we talked about it quite extensively, and he was decrying the fact that so much research goes into, you know, midlife diseases, as he put it, of, you know, middle-aged white men, but, you know, into the diseases of old age, into late-stage diseases that have already developed and that take a lot of costs and care to manage, and many of which, you know, could be prevented, delayed, lessened with the right early on management. And so what right. you're doing is really going to the beginning of a human life cycle and laying down, you know, the right baseline that will really support health and lessen all of these problems, you know. But we've had a very kind of laissez-faire attitude of we don't look at these early things. We just allow disease to happen. And this is not to blame anyone who develops an illness, of course. But, you know, we don't look at the causative factors and, you know, exactly. try to optimize. And it's so ignorant that in any other area. It would just, that would be, you know, strategic to handle it in that way. So it's such a strange kind of oversight. I mean, I don't know if you, but working in this area, perhaps you have thought of it. I mean, why? Is it all oriented as if disease is inevitable? And, you know, why don't we try to? Why don't we really, you know, switch the emphasis to, you know, intervening early to optimize?
Yeah, the paradigm has been that there's a lot of money to be made in managing diseases and trying to cure diseases, but not a lot of money to be made in trying to prevent diseases through public health strategies. I think it's about shifting that paradigm, right? It's about how do you incentivize that prevention piece. And the best time to start preventing disease is, you know, before you're even born. So many of the origins of the diseases and the illnesses that we grapple with as adults actually begin in utero. And so, you know, it's amazing in the science. We're learning so much every day about how critical that time period is, pregnancy, infancy, and early childhood to lifelong health. And so if we can figure out how we can, you know, sort of make that the priority in terms of the research dollars that we spend and that we invest as a country, you know, that will change everything. But, you know, it will also potentially put, you know, companies out of business. So, you know, it's how do you do that? And I mean, that's where public health matters, right? Because it takes that long-term thinking and it takes sort of the investment in saying, you know what, we need to keep the population healthy by preventing disease in the first place, recognizing that there's, you know, maybe not a lot of money to be made in that, because you're not selling, you know, Viagra, or you're not selling, you know, diabetes medication or whatever. But, you know, that's ultimately why we fight for the public health, because it's about living the sort of healthiest lives possible.
Well, you know, the thing is, there are different levels, you know. I mean, my answer to this or my thought about it is there are different levels of economy. So it's not that there's no money to be made. It's just not the, you know, billions and trillions of dollars, this, you
right.
know, really high net worth year after year after year that goes into the pockets of a few people with, you know, everyone
That's right.
else kind of struggling and straining and having health problems and less and less and less. So it's really, you know, it's using orienting the economics so that it's working for people, you know, rather than for, you know, for more people, for all people, rather than just a few people.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And so, you know, this goes to a very, it's a fundamental shift in social priority. And yet, again, through marketing, I think people have been taught to take for granted that this is a big untouchable and that nothing about the system can or should change. But, you know, you spend some years, as obviously you've done, as I've done, and, you know, there are others who've done this too, looking through the health lens, and it's just self-evident that this would be the more caring, more humane way to go. So...
Well, and the economics make sense when we think about the, you know, kind of the what it's costing us when we have, you know, high levels of obesity and, as you said, all the associated illnesses. You know, the healthcare costs, the burden to the healthcare system is enormous. And many of us pay for that burden, whether we know it or not or like it or not. And so it is actually smarter economics if we actually do the math to invest in the preventative strategies in public health. But that doesn't make Wall Street super happy.
No, I just was actually working on an op-ed for a publication that shall be nameless that made, you know, this entire argument. Have you looked into the numbers on this? Because I think this is an area ripe for further development. You know, when we talk about public health, it's either, you know, a semi-attentive group of bureaucrats who may themselves, you know, be subject to officials and lobbying and, you know, and kind of hamstrung in terms of what they're going to be able to do. Or it's, you know, medical people who are giving prescriptive advice but not looking at the overarching system that's creating these negative health impacts on such a, you know, broad and diverse level. So I always feel like, and economics not being my area, that we need some good analysis. We need some good numbers about the choices that, you know, we're making now and how we could do it better. Is this something that you guys have looked into, at a thousand days? Because I think that's real important.
Yes. Actually, mm-hmm. we have, and specifically around breastfeeding. So last year we were working with UNICEF, the World Health Organization, based on some research that we had also done with the World Bank, and we put together sort of the investment case for breastfeeding. And it shows that every $1 invested in enabling a mom to breastfeed generates about $35 in economic returns. And that $35 in economic returns is based on a couple things. On one, a reduction in the mortality in children and in mothers, which makes healthier, sort of a healthier, more productive workforce when you don't have, you know, your people dying from preventable diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing
mm-hmm.
is, as you recall, the breastfeeding is associated with higher IQ, and so it's the cognitive benefits of a child being breastfed means a smarter mm-hmm. workforce, means a workforce that is, you know, better able to compete in the growing knowledge economy. So we have done that economic analysis, and we've done it, in fact, for a couple different countries. We need to do it for the United States, but you know, in Nigeria alone, for example, the cost of not breastfeeding is about $21 billion per year that the Nigerian economy loses every year, or 4% of its gross national income. So the numbers are pretty big and pretty compelling. And so, you know, the goal of this was to take this conversation from one about, hey, this is just a health thing that only like the health people need to worry about. Actually, no, the finance ministers need to worry about this, right? The people that are in charge of economic planning and economic development strategies for their country need to worry about this. So, the economics are just as compelling as the health, sort of the health benefits.
Yes, and I would say also that people who have a growing mounting concern at this time to the future of democracy and democratic institutions,
mm-hmm.
A more cognitively astute electorate can only help.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
So, in terms of people going, what can we do and how can we do and what can we, where do we intervene, it may seem counterintuitive to intervene in the early lives of babies. But in fact, it's foundational, and it might be actually a very good place to intervene, providing that we also intervene on the environmental level, I would add, as an environmental reporter, so that we have any kind of steps toward a more stable habitat for these next generations is also critically important. So,
there's an angle that
me in there.
I love those 2 cents, because there's an angle that also hasn't been, I don't think, adequately explored, and that's the environmental impact of infant formula. So you think of the biggest polluters in the environment, or the biggest sources of greenhouse gases the meat. Dairy industry, right? And you think that the number one ingredient in infant formula is dairy. And then you add to that the processing, the packaging, the transport. And infant formula is not so green. It's not so great for the environment. So I think that's yet another reason and another sort of economic argument to be made for why, it's important we support breastfeeding.
That's very interesting. I mean, I also thought that the infant formula had soy in it, which is another one of these, kind of rampant mass agri crops that, kind of eats up the land, kind of burns it to dust, and, which contributes to loss of water on the planet, deforestation, and, climatological effects as well. Does it still have soy in it? Because I thought some of them did for some reason. Or have they taken that out?
There is some formula that is specifically formulated with soy for those babies that are you know, allergic to dairy or can't handle dairy. So that's an alternative, and that, you know, should be a minority of babies that sort of need that, you know, the soy-based formulas. But it's become very trendy and in vogue, and, you know, it's not something that every baby should be, or, you know, the majority of babies should be exposed to or should be drinking, especially given that formula, if you're choosing to use formula and using formula, formula is the only source of food for that baby for the first 6 months of their life. And so the baby getting that much soy in their diet is, you know, it's a little bit concerning. But again, for a minority of babies, that, you know, it's important to have that option. But yeah, should not be widespread.
That's a problem both from, I mean, it's a glyphosate problem, it's a climate problem, and it's also a estrogenic problem, you know, for newborns to be consuming an estrogenic food so early in life. You know, so, and if the dairy itself that you're mentioning is not organic, and, you know, it also has hormones and growth hormones and stuff in it, which is, you know, not what babies need and can be actually, you know, quite counterproductive from an, you know, to have estrogenic activity like that for a baby. They're not really, you know, that's not the time of life where that's, you know, menopausal women maybe, but not really for babies.
Well, I mean, it just comes down to the fact that infant formula is an industrially processed food. It's processed food, right? I mean, whether we like to, you know, believe that or not, it is. And, you know, I think, you know, there's been a lot of research that shows us that, you know, less consumption of processed food is better, right? Eliminating processed food from our diets in general is the sort of the healthiest way to go. So you think about that even for a baby, and that, it, you know, and it matters. It really does matter.
Yes, it really does. And we're coming down to the last, you know, 5 minutes or so of our show. I just want to, you know, say again, we're talking with we're talking about 1,000 Days, you know, the terrific organization that today's guest is speaking to us about with such great knowledge. And it's really interesting and talking to you, Lucy, how, you know, unpacking all of this makes it so obvious how something that just seems like one small thing is actually, you know, it reaches across so many different systems and has such a profound forward-moving global effect. So I also just want to encourage our listeners, if you've enjoyed this conversation with Lucy Sullivan of 1,000 Days, you know, please go to their website. You can support their organization, learn about their current activities, and, you know, kind of spread the word and participate also in the initiative for, you know, better support for early life maternal care so that mothers can be with their babies. I mean, one of the things that you said at the very beginning of the show, which I thought was so self-evident, and yet it's the kind of thing that we don't usually associate with biological scientific proof because we're not talking about a biochemical. You know, it can't be real if we can't study it biochemically. And while that, of course, is relevant to, for example, the substance in the milk and the substance in the formula, you know, the very idea that the cuddling and the closeness and the increase in maternal baby contact is itself promoting health in the child, brain development, you know, we want to always emphasize that, of course, but also feelings of comfort, safety, all of that, really, which is supportive to life, you know. And so we tend to leave that piece of it out because it's understudied probably. But on the other hand, it's self-evident. And so, you know, to people who, you know, have resonate with that and have that experience, and I think it needs to be validated as often as possible. So I also salute you and 1,000 Days for, you know, for those efforts, because that really creates the platform for healthy nutrition, you know, to be given and received, you know.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Allison. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you today.
Yes, it's been great having you on, and, you know, we'll share this widely. Listeners, if you've enjoyed the show, please share it with your networks as well. And after you listen to the program, it will also be available in the Connect the Dots archive at connectthedotspodbean.com. Thank you so much for your terrific work, Lucy Sullivan, and 1,000 Days. And I hope that you succeed and make tremendous inroads in shifting our social priorities in this life-giving, life-supportive, healthy way.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Have a great week and be well.
Well, 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 who, well.